It's pilot season, that time of year when television networks create and test out new shows with hopes of turning out the next big hit. But whatever new ideas they come up with for the plot, cops, zombies, yuppie apartments, it's safe to say that they will turn to the safety of a limited number of character archetypes. You know, the lovable loser, the charming rogue, the desperate housewife. Well, Emily Nussbaum, television critic for The New Yorker, would like to add a new TV archetype to that list, and she's calling it the hummingbird. Emily Nussbaum, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, before you define hummingbird for us, we have a few examples, we think, of the kind of character you're talking about.
There's nothing we can't do if we work hard, never sleep, and shirk all other responsibilities in our lives. You with me?
You promised nothing bad would happen if we stuck together, and now the worst possible thing is happening, and it's only happening to me!
You don't understand what's going on, any of you!
Ma'am?
Okay, the world is about to end, and we're standing around talking!
Oh, okay. We should say that's a mix of programs there, comedy and serious. Leslie Knope from NBC's Parks and Recreation, the character Sue Heck from the ABC sitcom The Middle, and, of course, the manic CIA agent Carrie Matheson from Showtime's Homeland. She's the one sounding really alarmed just then. So, Emily Nussbaum, what makes all these women hummingbirds?
Well, these are characters who are very tightly wound, highly ambitious, anxiety-provoking for the people around them and also for the audience watching the television show. But at the same time, they're highly idealistic. They're very, very driven. To me, what's fascinating about them is that they're not minor characters. They're not villains. They're not wacky best friends. They're the main character of the show. And the show itself tends to share their values and take their struggles seriously.
Why did the name Hummingbird work?
Well, I thought hummingbirds fit the bill simply because their wings flap incredibly fast. So it came from a Twitter brainstorm where people tried to come up with various ideas. And, you know, to me, hummingbirds' wings flap super fast. They hover in the air. They kind of suggest the mania and intensity of these characters. I realize they're not agitating necessarily. They're a valuable part of the ecosystem. But, you know, on the other hand, I would say the same of Leslie Knope and Carrie Matheson and Sue Heck.
So, Emily, you say that hummingbirds don't have to be women. They could also be men. But is there something gendered going on here? I mean, something about what we're seeing in female characters versus male characters on TV right now.
I do think there's something about the hummingbird that's gendered. To me, it seems like a second stage of something that's been going on with men for around the last decade, that on both dramas and comedies, in the form of anti-heroes and sad sacks like Louis, really going back in a lot of ways to Seinfeld, but Curb Your Enthusiasm, there are other examples. These are male characters that people don't necessarily have to like. In fact, the fact that the characters sometimes anger or disgust people who are watching is part of the appeal. There weren't so many female characters like this. Hummingbirds, to me, are associated with the rise of more complex and potentially off-putting female characters. And specifically, they have qualities that people find annoying about a certain kind of woman. And these characters are agitating in a way that I feel is risky and new and exciting.
So, Emily, where do we see the hummingbird in real life?
I actually think there's a level at which this might be some sort of national therapy reaction to the rise of Hillary Clinton and people's initial response to her, which was to put her down and then afterwards to receive her as a heroine for the exact qualities that she was put down for. And there's something about these characters that does remind me of not necessarily Hillary Clinton herself as an individual, but the iconic figure of the ambitious woman who is highly idealistic, tightly wound, and possibly agitating or irritating. And there is that moment where Obama said, "You're likable enough, Hillary," and this fraught question of likability is central to all of these characters.
It also seems to echo a conversation we're having about success and likability and forceful women in the workplace generally.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think it really is. It's this way in which creative fictional forms on television seem to work through national questions. And the question of what it means to be an ambitious and driven woman and whether it makes you a heroine or whether it makes you an irritant is, I think, a big one. And in these characters, because of the way the stories are told, we actually get in the end to root for the hummingbird and to recognize her value.
Emily Nussbaum, thank you so much for explaining this to us. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. That was fun. I realize it sounds a little crazy. I'm like, and the other thing about hummingbirds. But
you got a little hummingbird action going on.
I know. It definitely brings out a slightly weird, obsessive.
Look, just like from one to another. All right. Buzz on.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Emily Nussbaum, television critic for The New Yorker. She's in the process of developing a theory about a kind of television character who she calls a hummingbird.
Hummingbird, hummingbird should be your name.
Hummingbird should be your name.
Too restless, too subtle, too wild, too tame.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Well, a very clear hit has been the game Angry Birds. The company behind it, Rovio, says it is the number one paid app of all time. It's been downloaded 1.7 billion times. And starting tomorrow, the company that created Angry Birds is releasing a cartoon series directly through its games. That series will also be shown on international TV channels, though in the U.S., the main way to see it will be inside the mobile game. As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, Rovio is sidestepping traditional distribution deals with major Hollywood players.
Angry Birds is just so simple, says Rovio's Andrew Staubel.
They're very unique birds, with each with very special powers, that each of which get very upset and aggravated by the very rascalish pigs who have stolen their eggs.
In the game, players use slingshots to catapult the colorful birds, who don't fly, to destroy structures hiding the green pigs. The new Angry Birds cartoons go one step farther.
There's a whole infrastructure to the pigs' world. They live on an island that has some amazing stories to tell.
Staubo, who's in charge of Rovio's strategic partnerships, is only a little ambitious about how far his birds and pigs can fly.
I would describe them as most closely aligned to, say, Tom and Jerry. And I think we're thinking about really Looney Tunes for the mobile generation.
New 3-minute episodes will be revealed every week when players push a button on the 99-cent game app.
At its heart, you know, it's just fun to play. It's basically just slingshotting birds, so anyone can understand it.
Kirk Hamilton is features editor for Gawker Media's gaming website. He says the startup Rovio has already thrown the video gaming industry for a loop and could do the same for TV.
I think that's the thing that makes this really interesting, is that they have this huge embedded audience who all have a way to just give them money already. So they're just giving them more stuff to spend money on.
4 years after the small Finnish company launched its digital game, Rovio has become a major player in the entertainment world. Rovio joined forces with Lucasfilm to come up with a Star Wars Angry Birds cartoon, games, and merchandise. They've partnered with 20th Century Fox, National Geographic, and even NASA. There are now Angry Birds plush toys, lunchboxes, T-shirts, books, and Angry Birds theme parks in Europe and China. The company makes most of its money from merchandise and advertisers on its games and YouTube channel with more than 1 billion views. With its new cartoon series, Rovio is betting on new media to directly collect more revenue from its fans and advertising partners like Paramount Pictures and Sony Pictures and BlackBerry. Executive Vice President Stalbo says that puts Rovio in a unique position.
The world's changing, where a really small company of 12 people in Helsinki can compete with a big media company who has significantly more resources because the platforms are more accessible to everybody. So it's an exciting time for any startup out there because the playing field just got leveled.
In 3 years, Angry Birds is set to be a feature-length film. Where will it end? How long will the birds be angry? And when will those pigs stop stealing their eggs? Stalbo says there are generations of bad blood between them, so many more stories to tell on many different devices. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Michael McCann is a writer with Sports Illustrated. He's been covering what's probably the biggest story in sports in the last year, Lance Armstrong's fall from grace into a legal quagmire. McCann regularly responds to readers' questions on Twitter, and about a month ago, something very intriguing happened.
I noticed that at Lance Armstrong followed me on Twitter.
Now, McCann's thinking it can't be the Armstrong, right? Nevertheless, he began to exchange messages online. They never spoke by phone. Then 2 weeks ago, at Lance Armstrong invited McCann to come to Austin for an interview. If this were really Lance, it would be the only interview with Armstrong since the Oprah Winfrey appearance in January.
The whole time, my wife and other family members were a little bit skeptical that this was even real. Maybe this is a hoax. Maybe I'll go down there and it won't be him.
It really was Lance Armstrong, and they talked for 3 hours that day.
The only constraint I had is that I could not quote him directly on most topics, that I could paraphrase what he said. And of course, it limited how much I could reveal in terms of what he said.
So given all of that, how long did it last, and what did you learn that you hadn't known before?
The conversation lasted about 3 hours. And in terms of what I learned that I didn't know going in, I would say that he impressed me in terms of his willingness to talk about any topic. And I also learned some things that I didn't know. We talked, for instance, about the lawsuits that he brought against individuals that had basically said that he had doped, and he used litigation to counter those allegations. And we talked about why would he do that. He didn't blame his lawyers. He didn't blame his advisors. He did mention, however, that companies with which he had endorsement contracts had expected that he would respond aggressively to allegations. I would also say what I didn't know going in was that he's very much focused right now on litigation. His immediate short-term focus is on responding to a handful of lawsuits which threaten him tremendously.
That's so interesting, Michael. I mean, because in the Oprah Winfrey interview, he came off really as fairly robotic. I just have to ask you, did he express regret at having misled the public for so many years, all the denials about the doping? Did he say, I'm so terribly, terribly sorry?
Yeah, he did. And he raised that specifically when I said, what about all your fans? What about the fans that you've lost because of this? And he definitely expressed contrition about those that believed in him and that now are extremely disappointed in him. And I felt that it was genuine. You know, I can't get inside someone's heart, but I believe that he genuinely is disappointed that he's disappointed so many people, including people that believed in him so firmly. He did argue that if you look at, for instance, all of the lying that he had, he was asked the question about doping much more often than other cyclists, that the media and the public awareness was focused on him and not others who he argues were doing the same things that he was doing. And I think that was a theme that he tried to raise, is that his achievements were extraordinary and his cheating was only ordinary. Now, again, that doesn't defend cheating, but at least gets inside his mind to say he was still the top racer in an era where, at least he argues, everyone was cheating. Whether that's true, you know, people are going back and forth on that. I've had people email me saying that's categorically untrue. I've had others contact me saying it was true. I'm not in a position where I can really evaluate that claim, but I am looking into it.
That's Michael McCann. He's a legal analyst and writer for Sports Illustrated, and he also directs the Sports and Entertainment Law Program at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, country music singer Kacey Musgraves tells the truth about small town life. It's NPR News.